So today, like I said, we're looking at Leviticus 23 to 35. If you haven't figured out already, by the way, I have complimentary readings read usually for the scripture reading. So we'll get to why I had Exodus 3 read. But again, flipping to Leviticus 23, as I was prepping for this sermon, I literally could not get, I think it's Tevye from The Fiddler on the Roof, out of my head. Just the tradition. And that is what we're going to see in these three chapters. I know he said tradition a lot louder than that, but I didn't want to blast the mic here. But in 23 and through 25, these chapters are going to deal with traditions in the sacred calendar, traditions in the sacred presence, or the tabernacle, and then also traditions in the sacred years. I couldn't really come up with a better way for the third one, but basically, like, not monthly or yearly things, but like every so many years something happens. That's chapter 25. There is a lot to work through in these chapters, and I'm covering three chapters at a time. As I've mentioned many times, I'm not going to cover anything, so if you have questions about stuff, either come to me afterwards or text me, or we do have a Q&A at the end of the series, so you can bring up topics that I didn't really address on the way. But what I do want to focus on today is the main idea and point behind all of these God-ordained traditions, how they point forward to Christ, and then also what they have to teach us today. So as we begin chapter 23, the first tradition that we see, and again, this chapter has to do with the sacred calendar, so things that happen every year. The first thing that we see after the introduction, the first couple verses, is a tradition that happens every week. And this tradition is the Sabbath. If you read, starting in verse 3, 6 days work shall be done, but on the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work. It is a Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwelling places. This day, the Sabbath, which in our New Testament day, we kind of have reframed it to the first day of the week rather than the last day of the week. But this day was a day of rest from work. And this word work is something that there was, over the centuries, struggle to interpret what exactly that meant, hence why you have Jesus walking through the cornfields, his disciples pick some ears of corn, and they get kind of reprimanded for that, and then he has to explain, well, actually, guys, the Sabbath was made for man, not mad for the Sabbath. In other words, the Sabbath was supposed to be a benefit to you and a blessing to you, but you have actually turned this thing of blessing, and with your over-interpretations, have turned it into an overburdensome curse on yourselves, which really defeats the very purpose of it. So I want to dig into a little bit about what was that purpose? What is he getting at? What is Jesus pointing to and trying to remind them of as he's correcting the Pharisees who are trying to correct his disciples for doing something that they thought they weren't supposed to be doing on the Sabbath? So this word work is really kind of what it all gets back to. This word that is used, the idea behind it, some glosses, I guess, of the word are to send, to dispatch, or to assign. This word has to do with the idea of your daily or your assigned tasks, especially if you have a full-time occupation, or in this culture, a lot of people were farmers or shepherds or whatever that might be. And the goal on this day was, as much as possible, you refrained from those normal tasks that were your livelihood, essentially. And especially in our culture, this is something that kind of cuts to the core, because when people ask you about yourself, usually, especially in our culture, how we define ourselves is our job. And the goal of this Sabbath day is that there is one day a week where you are not a job title. You are a person. And you are a child of God who is called to catch your breath, to rest. It is a solemn day of rest. We'll get into the festivals going forward, but on the festival days or the feast days, holy convocation, the fancy word there, basically what that means is it's a festival or a feast day. On those days, the point of the resting was that you are resting from daily activities in order to celebrate. On this day, this Sabbath day, the point of your resting was rest. And in other words, as much as possible, your things that you are obliged to do to sustain yourself, whatever your livelihood is, let go of that for one day. And again, especially in our culture, I think this is just such a big challenge because it is hard for us to do that. If you look forward from this text to Isaiah 58, 13 to 14, it really gets to the heart of what is what is to be avoided on this day. It calls people not to look to their own affairs or strike bargains on this day. In other words, don't try to sneak in business on this day. So the goal of it is, again, you take a day, or at that time, the Sabbath, the seventh day of the week. To us, it's the first day, or, I mean, for Caleb and I, it's a little different because we work on this day. So it's basically like, take regular time to not be your job, to be a child of God, and to rest. And what is amazing, and I think historically pertinent to our text today, is remember that this is being given to a people who had just been liberated from the bondage of Egypt. And their work prior to this liberation had just been increased. So I wouldn't say that it's unfair to say that they were likely working 7 hard days a week. And now they have been freed by the Lord, liberated from Egypt, liberated from slavery. They are now servants. They are a kingdom and a nation that is God's now. He is effectively their new taskmaster. And their new taskmaster is telling them, you are no longer needing to work 7 days a week. In fact, I want you to take a day off every week and just rest, because I am a benevolent, gracious taskmaster. And I want you to realize also that you aren't ultimately in control of the outcome of your own life, because I am God, you are not. I think, especially back in this context where it was the seventh day of the week, I think one thing that's cool is man works for 6 days and rests on the seventh. This kind of reminds me, pointing forward, of the gospel, where it's we plant the seed and we water, but then God gives the increase. I think one of the cool things about the seventh day of rest is that we do the work, but then the result is up to God. I think there's a lot of symbolism here and a lot of freeing symbolism here, especially to this people who had just been liberated from this burdensome slavery that had been increased before they had gotten out of Egypt. So there is a lot of meaning behind this every week occurrence. And then as we move on to the less often occurrences, these are going to be considered in, depending on what translation you have, you're going to have feasts or festivals or assemblies or whatever. There's all sorts of different words that are used to translate these things. But the next one I want to look at, and I want to actually look at these in groups. So the next grouping is going to be 4 to 14, verses 4 to 14. And in this group, you're going to see the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the First Fruit Offering. And I'll explain why I'm grouping things together as we go here. But when you start in verse 4, these are the appointed feasts of the Lord, the holy convocations, which again, when you read convocation, and that's a big word, just think of like assembly or honestly a lot of like, especially the newer translation will do like festival or something like that. It's basically a day where you set aside and the people are called to gather for the purpose of community, worship, remembrance, celebration, whatever the kind of appropriate focus is of the day. But these are the appointed feasts of the Lord, the holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at the time appointed for them. In the first month, on the 14th day at twilight, is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation, and you shall not do any ordinary work, but you shall present a food offering to the Lord for 7 days. And on the 7th day is another holy convocation, and you shall not do any ordinary work. So I want to talk through kind of some of the timing here and some of the meaning behind what's going on here. So the first thing, when this happens, in the first month on the 14th day of the month. Now, I just want to take a step back and just talk about logistics a little bit in the calendar. We read that and it's kind of easy to think about, like, okay, January 14th. They're not operating on that calendar here. So we got to kind of reframe our minds to the Jewish calendar and what's going on with that for the timing. The calendar is a lunar calendar, which means that the months align with the phases of the moon, which with each month beginning on the new moon. So a couple different major differences already right off the bat. And then also the first month began in the spring. So like this isn't midwinter, 14th of January. Like we got to shift things around a little bit in our mind. Back in Exodus 12, we see that this specific month was chosen as the first month as a reminder to the people of the Passover and Exodus, which had happened in the spring. So basically, the Jewish calendar, the first month is in the spring because when they were liberated from Egypt, that was ordained to be the new beginning of their calendar, because it was effectively kind of a new beginning of the people of God. They'd been in slavery for 400 years, and now they're being liberated. It's kind of a new start for them. And that was reflected even in their calendar. So I know we're talking about like specific feasts and stuff like that, but like even in just their calendar itself, there's this reminder of what God has done for them. And then thinking about the fact that like even the calendar and then the first month, that all has to do with the Exodus and this theme of deliverance and the grace that God gave to them. Honestly, we're going to see these themes of deliverance and grace prominent and popping up all over the place throughout this whole sacred calendar and throughout everything that's coming up in all of these traditions. And then as far as the festival week, so these few days and what's going on here, the week starts with the Passover meal the night before. And then the first day is a sacred assembly for worship and celebration. And on the seventh day, there is another assembly. So what's going on with the timing here? Why is there like, okay, well, you start technically the night before, and then the first day right after that, like the next day, is the first celebration. So the Passover memorial was followed by a celebration. This timing here remembers that God's deliverance from the final plague happened at night. The people were told to sacrifice the Passover lamb, to smear the blood. That all happened at night. They had their Passover meal, and then during the night, actually go back to Exodus, it says at midnight the angel came and killed the firstborn, and then during the night, Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and told them to go, and in the morning they left. So this is hearkening directly back to literally the sequence of events. So having the Passover lamb at twilight reminded the people that, like, back in Egypt, you prepared for this deliverance and you knew this plague was coming at night. And then in the morning, you were free. So in the morning is when this sacred assembly day happens, this celebration day, just as it had happened back then, that they were freed during the night. And then in the morning, they were a newly liberated people. So I just think that's really cool. That's actually following the direct timing that you see in the text back in Exodus. And then as far as the first fruits offering, this is something that, depending on your translation, may or may not be included with this sequence of events here. But I would argue that looking from 9 to 14, this first fruits offering, it said it was given on the day after the Sabbath. This has been traditionally understood, and I would argue it to be best understood as the Sunday immediately following the Passover. So you have all these things happening at once. And I'll get back to there in a minute. But like the first fruit offerings, what it symbolized was gratitude to and dependence on God for the coming harvest and the acknowledgement that until God receives his share of the new grain crop, nobody may eat it. So you have a lot of stuff going on all at once in these few days. So depending on where the 14th day of the month hit, at twilight you had the Passover. And then on the 15th, you had the first celebration, and then you had a few days where they only eat unleavened bread, which the eating of unleavened bread, by the way, reminded them of the haste with which they had to eat the sacrificial lamb and the meal, because they were rushing out of Egypt the next morning, and then they were traveling for quite a while, which is really shortened down into 7 days. But like, there's just symbolism and memory packed into all of it. And then during this time also, so again, wherever the 14th to 15th hit during the day, which they're going to move because there are days, they're not like, it's not a set, like the second Sunday or whatever. Wherever that first Sunday was, you have the first fruit offering happening at that time. And we'll get there in a little bit with like all the kind of symbolism that's happening with the first fruits. But again, this is a liberation, the first Exodus. And I say it that way on purpose because the Exodus theme is picked up and repeated so much throughout Scripture that in a way you could think of the fact that this first Exodus was kind of the first fruits, the first foreshadowing of the greater Exodus to come. So you have like the literal thanking God for the first fruits, like literally the first fruits of what we've harvested. We're starting to get, depending on what plants you've planted and when, whatever, we're starting to get some stuff. So we offer that to God as his first share of the new harvest so that we can then be able to eat as we harvest it because we've already given our portion to God. But then you also have even behind that literal meaning, you have a symbolic meaning of this first fruits of freedom, this first fruits of liberation. So I'd argue it's actually very helpful and beneficial and also just cool to understand them all happening at once. And that's how it's traditionally been understood as well, is that this first fruit offering does happen during this week. So that's a few things happening all at once in 4 to 14. And then in 15 to 22, you have the Feast of Weeks, which is also called Pentecost. And it's called Pentecost, by the way, because the Greek word for 50th is Pentecost. And we get that from the fact that they were supposed to count 50 days from the first fruit offering to this Feast of Weeks celebration. And the method of counting, by the way, like, depends kind of, I guess, on how much you care about these things or how much you pay attention to, like, numbers and stuff as they're going. But when you read that you're supposed to start counting on a Sunday, so the first day of the week, and then the 50th day is still a Sunday, to us in our method of counting, we're like, that should be a Monday, because we start with, like, okay, we say if you start Sunday, okay, Monday is day one. That's not how the Jews count. If you start counting on Sunday, Sunday is day one. So that's how you still wind up on a Sunday, on day 50. So if you're curious about how that worked, that's how that plays out. And that's also, by the way, why Jesus is said to be in the grave for 3 days, even though he was buried on Friday and rose on Sunday, because he was in the grave on part of Friday, all of Saturday, part of Sunday. So they count the first day as one. So you have one, two, three. So anyways, just kind of a side note of how the Jews count, and they do start on one with the first day. But the first fruit offering, getting back to that, that opened these 50 days. And now, 50 days later, you have another grain offering at the end of the harvest that closes the 50 days with a sacred assembly. The 50 days then open and close with gratitude to God for the harvest and an acknowledgement that it all comes from him and belongs to him. And then moving on to 23 to 25, the Feast of Trumpets. I'm going to read this one because it's really short. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall observe a day of solemn rest, a memorial proclaimed with blast of trumpets, a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work, and you shall present a food offering to the Lord." This Feast of Trumpets was a day of assembly proclaimed with trumpets, obviously, and it commemorated the end of the agricultural year and the last month of sacred assembly. Because your sacred assemblies are pretty packed, honestly, like in the spring and the fall. And then later on, you have Purim added regarding all the stuff that happened with Esther and the people of Israel at that point, but that was later. So right now, they're kind of all packed in two different locations. And again, this one, honestly, is more just an announcement that, like, the end of harvest is coming and that this month is the last festival month. So that's pretty much all that's going on for that day. It's more of an announcement, like, this month, this kind of month is kind of a big deal. And then the Day of Atonement, which we've already discussed, happens on the 10th day of this month. Because we did a whole sermon on that one, I'm not going to rehash that one. But just know that that happens on the 10th day. So the Feast of Trumpets is the first day. Day of Atonement is the 10th day. And then in 33 to 34, you have the Feast of Booths, which is also called the Feast of Ingathering. It's also called the Feast of Tabernacles, but I personally don't really like that one because the word for tabernacle and booth are not the same. We get to calling it the Feast of Tabernacles because of some theologizing that's happening, but as always throughout this whole series, I'd argue you have to start with the original intent first, and then you can add in your theologizing, but until you've done the original work, you shouldn't be adding in the theologizing. So to skip to calling it Feast of Tabernacles, I think, kind of shortcuts yourself. So anyways, the Feast of Booths, Feast of Ingathering. This feast celebrated the end of the harvest, because like I said, the trumpets kind of announced, like, this is the final month of celebrations as we think about the end of the harvest here. It is similar to the Feast of Unleavened Bread in that there is a sacred assembly on the first and the last day. So pretty much at the beginning of the harvest, you have a week-long festival, and at the end of the harvest, you have a week-long festival. It commemorated the journey from Egypt to Canaan by having the people live in temporary shelters for the week, just like they lived in temporary shelters then for much longer. But again, you kind of have a truncation here for practicality reasons. The people are still on this journey currently, because if you think about Leviticus, like, we're not in the promised land yet. So it almost feels kind of weird reading this, like, well, they're living in tents and then they're supposed to live in booths. It's like, well, they're kind of setting up this tradition thinking forward as well, so that when they're living in buildings, they will then have to switch to live in more temporary shelters for the week. So it gets even more meaning later on when they're in Canaan. And that's why, again, this is said to be ordained that all the generations to come will do this. After they have entered the land of Canaan and dwell in good buildings, they are called to remember their journey to get there, that God's goodness and provision for them on the way was what sustained them, and that they are only in the land due to God's grace and his choice of them as his people. You can read about that made very explicitly clear in Deuteronomy, where there's this giant warning about, don't forget the Lord your God when you come into the good land and you taste the goodness and you reap its benefits. Don't forget the God who is your God and who brought you there, and the fact that he didn't do this because you're some special perfect people. In fact, on the way, you rebelled against him all the time, but he's chosen you and covenanted himself to you as your God. So you have like a very lengthy reminder of this in Deuteronomy before they get in the land. But this feast, getting back to the feast here, it gives thanks to God for the year's harvest and also for their, once they get in the land, for their more permanent dwellings in the promised land. So that is a very brief, and again, I'm sorry if I didn't dig into some of these as much as you would have wanted me to, but that's a very brief overview of the sacred calendar. I'm going to move on to sacred presence, which I'd argue is the theme of Leviticus 24. And in this chapter feels a bit random at first when you read it, which is, again, why I've kind of tipped my hand that it's all about sacred presence. And why I argue that is because the first few verses, the lamp, the constantly burning lamp, which, by the way, this is the menorah, this lamp, and then the constant presentation of bread, or the bread of the presence, or the bread of the tabernacle, depending on how you have it headed in your translation. But the lamp that's constantly burning, the bread that is constantly present, and then in the next few verses about blasphemy, the constant awareness of how one speaks about God are all reminders that God is home and that God is present in the camp. Effectively, what's going on with the constantly burning light and the constantly burning bread is that the light's always on. Someone's always home. God is always there. And then the bread of the presence is this continual offering from 12 loaves, 12 tribes that are constantly giving an offering to the Lord. So there's this theme of continual presence there. And then that's also made clear in how we speak about the God who is there and who hears us and who is present. And when you call on his name, especially in a legal context, you're essentially bringing him into that legal setting. And therefore, how you talk about him and use his name ought to be respectful and to be associated with the things that he is associated with. But getting to this blasphemy account here, which is in 10 through the end of the chapter, 10 through 23, basically what happens is a half-Israelite, so he's half-Israel, half-Egyptian, he cursed God's name and was put to death because of it. Your translation, depending on what translation you have, might say he blasphemed the name and cursed. I would argue it'd be better to understand these two together. It's supposed to be one idea. He blasphemed by cursing the name. So there's a specific way in which he blasphemed here. He basically blasphemed by speaking God's name, in other words, talking about God's person, speaking God's name with explicit contempt and disrespect by cursing or demeaning or denouncing his name. The punishment for this is death, just like idolatry, which is punished by death, or at least with being cut off. Idolatry says, I worship a different God other than you, which is a way of showing contempt and at least disloyalty. Blasphemy by cursing shows explicit contempt and is therefore certainly also disloyalty. So again, the logic of the two punishments is kind of the same. If you're practicing idolatry, you are showing a rejection and a contempt for God by worshiping other gods. If you're blaspheming his name, especially by cursing and demeaning and belittling his name, you are also showing a contempt and a disloyalty for God. So it's effectively the same thing that's happening, just in two different ways, and that's why the punishment's very similar. And you kind of seemingly have this random list of punishments that's happening at the end here. I would argue that kind of why this comes up here is because, again, the man who did this is half Israelite. So I think there's a clarification being given here that these punishments apply to the native and the sojourner, which is why you have that language in there. So it's like this might have come up as a question. It's like, well, he's not fully Israelite, so the punishments, are they still the same? And he's like, look, if he's living in the camp, the punishments are the same. If he's a sojourner, he's a native, he's half Israelite, same punishment. You don't do this if you are part of and in the camp with my people. So that's 24. When you get to 25, this is, again, for lack of a better word, the sacred years. You have the Sabbath year and then the year of Jubilee. The theme of this chapter is seen in verses 23 and 24. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. You are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption of the land. In other words, to kind of briefly summarize what that's saying is, God is saying, look, you, when you come into the land, you ought to never think of yourselves as the only land owner, and that sales that happen are permanent, and that you have permanent right to whatever you happen to be able to acquire. In reality, I am the landowner, I being God, and you are all leasing from me. And what I'm going to do every 50 years is reset it to the way that I wanted it to be originally. That's what's basically happening in the Jubilee. The year of Sabbath, briefly first, though. The Sabbath is a rest for the land. The people were called to rest every 7 days, and God as the landowner, he's their king, but he's also their landowner. So as their king, he calls them to rest every 7 days. As their landowner, he calls them to rest the land every 7 years. So there's kind of a connection there between the Sabbath and the Sabbath year. And then also, like I said, with the Jubilee, every 50 years, there's essentially a reset in which the original owners of the land regain their property, which is why, again, you have in the wording there in 23, the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, meaning that, like, sales are not forever. And then in 24, in all the country you shall allow a redemption of land. In other words, the original land owner, the person that God had ordained and set aside for that land, always has the ability to redeem it. And if they aren't able to redeem it, if nothing else, on the year of Jubilee, it will be given back to them. What we have in the year of Jubilee is essentially the land being put back to how God had originally allotted it to the people before the effects of the curse that resulted in people becoming servants to one another and having to sell their land. The year of Jubilee started, amazingly, and very pointedly, I would argue, on the Day of Atonement. Notice that does not start on the first of the year. It starts on the Day of Atonement and goes to the next Day of Atonement. Just as the Day of Atonement is a day, as we discussed a few weeks ago, is a day of total ritual and sin decontamination, the Jubilee extends this decontamination to the socioeconomic pollution. I'm going to explain that a little bit. Slavery, indentured servanthood, the selling of property, these were all viewed as types of disruption, chaos, or pollution. In other words, if these things were happening, this was not how it was intended to be. A lot of times you have hardships involved, so whether it's maybe the curse of nature, you have bad weather or whatever affects somebody's livelihood, or you have curses of relationships, curses of sin nature, where shady things are done and somebody acquires one land or whatever, or like just somebody isn't taking responsibility and care of the land as they ought to be. So like all of these things are viewed as chaos forces, as disruptors to the natural order that God had ordained. And therefore, there is this socioeconomic pollution that's taking place and building up over 50 years. So just as the Day of Atonement is a yearly, effectively deep clean of the people in their ritual and moral pollution, there is also a 50-yearly deep clean of the land itself. The year of Jubilee was designed to break any cycles of poverty that had begun and to restore the land back to the correlation of people to land that God had ordained. On the very day that the ritual and spiritual purity of the land was restored, so also every 50 years, the people in the land returned to their original sacred distribution. Eden, in effect, is restored. Man in purity, again, Day of Atonement, man in purity dwells in the land that God had brought him into as he had been brought there. Just as God brought Adam into the Garden of Eden. there is a purposeful shadow, kind of echoing, back to Eden here. So those are the three chapters. And again, I'm sorry if I didn't get into some stuff that you wanted me to in those chapters, but I want to kind of hit the main themes and what's happening with all these traditions here. I want to look at a couple major things as far as application goes. The first thing I want to look at, as always, is looking forward, the fact that Jesus fulfills literally every single one of these sacred traditions has just been amazing to me as I work through this whole book and how Jesus is literally the fulfillment of everything in Leviticus. So the sacred calendar, chapter 23. Christ is our Passover lamb. He is our liberator from the bondage of sin and death. He is our Passover event, effectively. And what's really cool, after 400 years of slavery, which also, by the way, God was silent. We don't have much going on as far as revelation during that 400 years. After 400 years of slavery and silence, God sent Moses. And then later, after 400 years of silence and subjugation to Rome and to other countries, God sent Jesus. As our perfect Passover sacrifice, he had the Passover meal with his disciples, was crucified the next day, and then rose 3 days later on the day of first fruits offerings, as our first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. When he sent the Holy Spirit to the apostles on the day of Pentecost and added 5,000 to the church in one day, he pictured the full harvest of believers from every tribe and tongue. He is coming at the end of the harvest of believers, and this will be announced by trumpets, Feast of Trumpets. On the final day of atonement, all evil, sin, and death will be forever purged, and everything will be not just reset for another year, but restored and renewed forever. And then we will dwell with God forever in places prepared for us. Our journey to the final and perfect promised land will be over. There will be no more need for the Feast of Booths. And just like the Israelites coming into the promised land of Canaan, we will be there because of the work that he did for us and his grace alone, the exact things that the Feast of Booths was meant to remind them of. The sacred presence. The menorah was a constantly burning lamp that was the only source of light in the tabernacle. So Christ, the light of the world, is the only true source of light. The 12 loaves of bread, representing the 12 tribes, were a constant pleasing sacrifice in the presence of God. So Christ, whose work and sacrifice was pleasing to God on our behalf, stands constantly in the presence of God. The sacred years. Romans 8:22 says that the earth itself groans in anticipation of its final Sabbath year, its final Sabbath rest and renewal, which we read will happen in Revelation 21:1 after the second return of Christ, when all is made new. In Luke 4, we read that Jesus in his hometown read from Isaiah 61 in the synagogue. He read, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." He is proclaiming, in short, that he is the fulfillment of the year of Jubilee. Notice, however, if you look at Isaiah 61, 1 to 2, he read 61, 1 through 2a. He stopped short of the phrase which says, "and the day of vengeance of our God." He knew that his first coming was the fulfillment of the day of Jubilee part one. There is a coming part two. He came the first time in forgiveness to offer salvation and liberty from bondage of sin and death. And he is coming again to fulfill Isaiah 61, 2b, the vengeance of the Lord when he comes in judgment. So Christ fulfills every single one of these traditions. The second thing I want us to think about is that God still calls us to remember. In our scripture reading today, the people were called to remember their day of liberation from Egypt, to keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread every year, to explain to their children the meaning behind it. It was to be as powerful as a reminder as if it was a sign on their hand and a memorial between their eyes. So also the sacrifice of the firstborn male of animals and the redemption of the firstborn sons reminded the people of the final plague and God's protection for them from it. Throughout the Bible, both Old and New Testament, God consistently tells the people to pause, reflect, and remember. They build stone memorials. They hold regular feasts as memorials to past events and to present providence. And they take part in a ritual and sacrificial system that, as we have seen throughout all of the weeks of this series, is absolutely filled with traditions and rituals that are full of meaning, looking to the past, the present, and the future. In the New Testament, it's easy to feel that these things largely no longer apply, since they are, as we read in Colossians 2:17, a shadow of the things that were to come. And this is right, but only to a certain extent. God is still very much concerned that we remember. And he still today has given us traditions to do so. For what are baptism and the Lord's Supper but traditions? They are certainly more than traditions, with their deep meaning. How in baptism, we, when we are put underwater, are symbolically joined with Christ in his death, that he died in our place. And how we are then symbolically, as we come out of the water, participating with him in new life and a foreshadowing of the resurrection on the last day. And then in the Lord's Supper, it is packed with meaning about our unity with Christ as a family of God and how we now have constant communion with him. And as we've talked about in Leviticus, how it was just the priests who were able to participate in a lot of the meals, but we as God's New Testament priests are able to participate in that meal every time with him. No matter how new of a Christian you are able to participate in the Lord's Supper. So these are certainly more than traditions, but they are also certainly not less than traditions. And God's call to the people in Deuteronomy 6 to teach their children to bind these words as a sign on their hands and as frontlets on their eyes, to write them on the doorposts and the gates, to, in other words, regularly remember and teach his words through figurative and literal traditions and symbols, this is certainly still contained in our New Testament call to bring up our children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. The church, Jews and Gentiles, now joined together, no longer practice all of these Jewish festival days, but that does not mean that we are no longer to be intentional about traditions that cause us to pause, reflect, and remember. These traditions can show our gratitude for present blessings, and they can point our eyes to certain future. The Israelites, God's people, journeyed to the Promised Land, and they were a stubborn and forgetful people. We, the church, God's people today, are still a stubborn and forgetful people. For all the good that the Reformation certainly did, one of the areas that some of the reformers went too far was to abolish holidays. There were some reformers that saw the abuses that the Catholic Church was practicing in how they were practicing the traditional holy days like Easter, Christmas, Palm Sunday, Good Friday, other days, and they abandoned them altogether. I would argue that was certainly throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I would strongly argue that traditions, holy days, are good and helpful to keep and to observe. We have baptism in the Lord's Supper, but let us also keep Palm Sunday, Good Friday, Easter, and Christmas. Let us not just use Thanksgiving, but every other national holiday as an excuse to pause, reflect, remember, and reorient our mind. Let us create new and unique ways and traditions for ourselves and our families to remember what God has done for us and to remember where he is bringing us. I like to joke, especially about Christmas and Christmas music, that the theme of Christmas is something that we should be focusing on all year round, and therefore I listen to Christmas music all year round. But at the same time, I don't say that, hopefully, and when you hear it, me say that, I hope that it doesn't come across as me trying to say that we shouldn't be celebrating Christmas. I think there is still something helpful and needed, and especially to children, something magical about Christmas, about Easter, about these holidays, about how they can help us to remember something that we so easily forget, to encourage us to dig into these truths and to just simply pause and glorify God for what he has done, where we are, and where we are going. So just as God called the Israelites in these three chapters to not forget, but to remember, let us also not forget, but let us remember the Lord. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you that you remember our frame, you remember that we are dust, and you remember that we are a forgetful people, and that we so easily get caught up in our own lives, in our own affairs. We forget to set aside regular time for you. We are so much so that we need this on a weekly basis, and you know that. You know that we need days to reset our mind, to reorient ourselves, and to remember you and your goodness, even in the midst of difficult circumstances, that you call us to remember who you are, your grace to us that can always be found. And I thank you for the certainty that no matter what we are going through here on earth, that you have prepared a place for us, that though we now dwell in temporary buildings, as permanent as they may feel, that one day we will be in the home, in the room that you have prepared for us in your Father's house. I pray all this in your name. Amen.